Good evening. To generate our motivation, really with that big mind, think of all the different sentient beings, not only human beings, but animals, insects, the sky, under the sea, and the earth, all the beings in the different realms of existence, in the God realms, and hungry ghost realms, hellish realms. They're all having their own individual experiences right now, according to their karma, whatever karma is ripening at this moment. And yet all these beings who are just going through the experience of their karma uncontrollably, they all want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. And they've all been tremendously kind to us in the past. And so seeing them just buffered around by their afflictions and karma, it's so sad. It's like we can't stand to see that. And we want to do something to protect them, to help them. But what can we do, because we're in the same situation, buffeted around by our karma and afflictions? And so we have to attain liberation to be able to benefit them. And we have to eliminate the hindrance of the self-centered thought to be able to benefit them as well. And so we generate the bodhicitta motivation, aspiring for full Buddhahood, for the benefit of all living beings. This situation of sentient beings just getting buffeted around here, there, knocked around, you know, by their afflictions and karma. It really is kind of unbearable to think about it. And then when we think, okay, I've got to really become a Buddha because, you know, it's intolerable. I want to be able to do something to help them, you know, and I'm done with this self-centered thought that is keeping me from helping them. And it feels really sure then at that time. And then 5 minutes later, somebody does some small thing that we don't like. It's like, they're harming me. They don't like me. They set the table and didn't put a fork by my place. They gave everybody else a fork, not me. This means they don't like me. Well, I don't like them anyway. Doesn't matter. I'm out of here. Yeah, right? That's the way we are. You know, we have this incredible feeling of bodhicitta. And then some small, piccolissimo thing. And it's like, you know, forget bodhicitta. Just even a little bit of kindness or giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. We can't even do that. You know? It's like the self-centered mind just crashes down on us. And it's, you know, the whole world is against us, and they don't appreciate us, and they don't love us, and they're out to get us, and They're making fun of us, and they're doing exactly what they know we don't like because they really want to be. You know, we knew it all along, right? Right? You know? They don't care about me at all. In fact, they want me out of here. So, I want to be out of here because I don't care about them either. Pack my bags. Then what?
Same
yeah.
Same old.
It's the same old, isn't it? Then we have to carry our own luggage down the hill. Nobody will even help us carry it. Yeah. Finally, I'm leaving just what I knew they always wanted me to do. And they won't even help me carry my luggage down the hill. Yeah. And then we come to teachings of bodhicitta. All these said you're being suffering. I've got to do something. You know, for everybody. But all those people who are out to get me. Unfortunately, there's a lot of them, so I don't have to benefit too many sentient beings. In fact, the only one I have to benefit is myself, because everybody else is against me. So you see, self-centered attitude was right after all. Right? This is the way we are. Okay, so it's important to, you know, not just generate bodhicitta before teachings, but try and keep it in the mind a little bit, and to really recognize the self-centered thought when it rears its head. Yeah. To really just, you know, say to ourselves, this is the same old self-centered thought. Yeah. Maybe a new person, maybe a new incident, but the way of thinking, so familiar, isn't it? Yeah. We've just done it again and again and again. And where's it gotten us? Yeah? Where does it get us, this view of, you know, nobody cares about me, and they're trying to hurt me, and I'm doing my best. They should cut some slack and accept me the way I am. Yeah, they should really accept me the way I am. Who do they think they are for not accepting me the way I am? They're just a bunch of selfish people. Yeah? Trying to practice compassion, but they aren't really. They're just thinking of themselves. They should have some compassion for me and accept me exactly the way I am. Right? Right? Yeah, definitely. It sounds good. It sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah? Yeah, exactly. I don't have to accept them because they're just selfish. Why should I accept them for the way they are? You know, how can I accept all these selfish people for the way they are? They don't, you know. They need to improve, especially the Dharma practitioners. They should definitely improve. Lama Yeshe used to do this kind of thing with us, and, you know, just, we have to laugh at ourselves, don't we? We have to laugh at ourselves.
Enlightenment would mean if they do what I want.
Well, of course, you had any other definition of enlightenment than they do what I want? Yeah, I mean,
the conclusion is
enlightenment is everybody does what I want them, because I know what's best for all of them. Yeah, and I'm only trying to help them, and so when I tell them what to do, for God's sake, they should listen. Because I'm trying to help them, you know. Then they'll be enlightened and I'll be enlightened. Yeah, we'll all live happily ever after, now that everybody's doing what I want. But those stupid sentient beings, they just don't cooperate, do they? Yeah? What are we going to do with them? Throw them in the ocean? Throw them out the window? Run away to the top of Mount Tara? Where are we going to go where we're not with other sentient beings? Where are we going to go where we can live all by ourselves without any help from anybody? Where are we going to go and live where we don't have to depend on anybody? Yeah? Possible. Possible. Okay, maybe we should talk about emptiness. That's nice and confusing. So then we don't have to think about our self-centered thought. We can distract it by thinking about emptiness.
Yeah, where's that chart?
Yeah, where's that chart? I kept forgetting. Oh, yeah. I'm not self-centered, am I? I'm involved in the selflessness person stuff. I'm refuting the permanent, partless, independent self. Never had one anyway. Might as well refute it. And then the self-sufficient, substantially existent self. That one just causes a big headache. You know, and then the truly existent self. Get a bit of that one. Okay, got emptiness down. It's inexpressible. So there's nothing much to say about it. Or it's just too confusing to make heads or tails of. But, you know, it distracts me from, I don't have to think of, you know, how my self-centered thought is running the show day in and day out.
If we're meditating on emptiness properly, shouldn't that be what we're looking at?
If we're meditating on emptiness properly, shouldn't that be what we're looking at? Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. But what I'm saying is that, you know, we're often up in here with all of our ideas about emptiness. Yeah? And we're not applying it. Yeah. And even not applying emptiness, even applying the simpler antidotes to afflictions, you know. We're completely out to lunch with that. Oh, yes, mind training like rays of the sun. Oh, yes, cherish all sentient beings before yourself. Take on their suffering. Try and help everybody as much as you can. It sounds like what my mother taught me in kindergarten. It is, but we still didn't learn it, so Buddha's teaching us again. But Buddha's teaching us a little bit more advanced class, you know, and how to deal with attachment, how to deal with anger, how to deal with resentment. But when attachment comes in the mind, do we remember to apply the antidote? Do we even notice it's attachment? When anger's in the mind, do we apply the antidote? Or do we sit there and just get really good and mad at somebody? Yeah. My mind is not under the influence of afflictions right now. That person did something harmful to me. What I'm feeling is right. You know, they are doing something harmful and I'm hurt by it. I'm not angry at all. There's no antidote I need to apply. You change. I mean, that's the way we are, isn't it? You know? I mean, even not applying emptiness, just the antidotes to anger. We can't even admit we're angry. We can't even admit we're hurt. Yeah? We're so into, you know, whatever I'm feeling is true, whatever, however I interpret a situation, however something appears to me, is the absolute objective truth, with a capital T. Yeah? And so we go through our life like that. You know, everything is the objective truth, so how I react to it is the only possible way anybody could react. Yeah? And I have no control except to make everybody else change. But the Buddha said, when you get angry, to meditate on patience. I sure hope those people do that. And he also said, when there's attachment, meditate on impermanence. I sure hope they do that. Because when they don't, they dump all their afflictions on me, and it's really unpleasant. Isn't it? These people are so attached, and they want this, they want that, always pestering you. You know? They're so angry and irascible and irritated and, you know, so prickly, so easily offended. We should get their act together after all. You know, realize that their minds are under the influence of afflictions. So it's really back to the drawing board, isn't it? It's back to square one. It's, you know, what's going on inside of me, and what's, you know, is my mind under the influence of afflictions? And if it is, what am I going to do about it? Or am I just going to sign off and say there's nothing I can do about it because it's the other person who created the situation? Yeah. But that's what we've been doing since beginningless time, is saying it's the other person. Yeah. We keep doing it. It keeps not working. And we keep doing it. Yeah. So I think the real freedom that we have is when, you know, we realize that, you know, things happen, situations come up, but I can change my perspective on them. I can change how I'm looking at those situations so that I don't feel so hurt and angry and, you know, pushed away and rejected and abandoned and all that other stuff. Yeah, there are, you know, other ways to look at the situation besides the one that makes me miserable. But it, you know, it takes practice, so we have to practice, you know, we have to do it. But this is our one lifeline, you know, it's the one lifeline. And I remember many years ago after I left Italy and left Sam several thousand miles behind, you know, dear Sam, the topic of my stories and working with anger. And I went to do retreat. I was doing four sessions a day, and I would get so angry. I was like, I was in Asia, Sam was in Europe. I was getting so angry just thinking about this person. And so I'd get angry, and then I'd, you know, meditate on patience, calm myself down. It was okay, you know. Then the next session, got angry again. You know, my whole retreat, it was, I did retreat 3 or 4 months, was basically about trying to work with my mind about this anger, you know. And I just had to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, you know. And it improved somewhat. Yeah. Just by the force of habit, because when you do things, then, you know, the more you get familiar with something, the easier it gets. Yeah. Okay. Now I know everybody's thinking, she's telling me I'm selfish. She only means me. She's talking directly to me, not to anybody else in this room. She's criticizing me. Even the people on the, you know, on the telephone, on the internet. Why is she talking to me? You know, I'm sure everybody else in this room is just as selfish as I am. Why is she singling me out? Right? No, you're not thinking like that. She said that it's all the other people that are doing this. Okay. So, we're going to read a little bit from the book, certain segments of the book, okay? Okay, so, we were saying that, you know, there's a difference between innate ignorance and acquired ignorance, okay? Innate ignorance being what we've had since beginningless time, that everybody has, babies, animals, you know, it doesn't depend on gross language like we have. And then there's acquired ignorance that we learn through thinking about things in an erroneous way, okay, through learning incorrect philosophies or things like that. So, the permanent, partless, independent self is an acquired kind of ignorance. And then the self-sufficient, substantially existent self, the truly existent self, are they have both innate and acquired. Okay, so the supplement, okay, who wrote the supplement? Chandrakirti. Okay. Says, even those who have spent many eons as animals and have not beheld an unproduced or permanent self are seen to be involved in the misconception of an I. Okay? So even animals who don't have this philosophy of there being a permanent soul, they still have the idea of I. That's the innate ignorance. If the object of intellectually acquired ignorance is taken as the measure for establishing the object of negation, the object of negation will be too narrow. That means if the object of the intellectually acquired ignorance, okay, for example, permanent, partless, independent self, if that's taken as the object, what you are refuting, then that you're not refuting enough. Your object of negation is too narrow. Consequently, if we were to familiarize ourselves with the objects to be realized through such negation, liberation would not occur, because the object of the mode of apprehension, which conceives of persons, aggregates, and so forth, as existing by way of their own characteristics, would not be dispelled. Okay? So even if we were to realize the absence of a permanent, partless, independent self, we still would not attain liberation, because we aren't removing the innate ignorance that is at the root of samsara. Okay? Because we're not negating the object of the mode of apprehension. I usually translate that as apprehended object. Yeah, it's easier than object of the mode of apprehension. The apprehended object, also the conceived object of ignorance. So it's the truly existent person, the truly existent aggregates. Okay. And then the precious garland, which was written by Nagarjuna, says, so long as the, and this is a very, very famous quote here, so long as the aggregates are misconceived, an I is misconceived upon them. If this conception of an I exists, there is action which results in birth. Okay? So long as the aggregates are misconceived, Yeah, an I is misconceived upon them. In other words, first, in the sequence of how things develop, first there is grasping at truly existent aggregates. Then on the basis of that, there's grasping at a truly existent person. Okay? Because, remember, the self is labeled independence upon the aggregates. So if you grasp the aggregates as truly existent, then independence upon that, you grasp the person as truly existent. So this is one reason why it's important not to refute not only the self of persons, but also the self of phenomena. Because if you don't refute truly existent aggregates and other things, as long as that grasping is there, then you're going to have the grasping at the person as well. Okay? So, if this conception of an I exists, in other words, the conception, or here conception means grasping. Yeah, it doesn't mean intellectual conception, it means grasping. So if the grasping of a truly existent I exists, there is action which results in birth. So this is talking about the 12 links. If there's the first link, which is grasping at a truly existent self, then that produces afflictions, and out of afflictions we create karma. Karma is the second link in the dependent arising. Okay? That karma puts seeds on the consciousness, and then when those seeds are ripened, then another rebirth in samsara occurs, if the karma was such that it was a full karma with all the parts intact. Okay. So what it's saying here, if you go backwards, is if you want to stop being born in samsara, you have to stop creating the karma that causes us, which means that you have to get rid of the ignorance, which means you have to refute the object of apprehension of that ignorance, okay, on the person and on the aggregates. According to our own system, there are two types of ignorance, and that which acts as the root of cyclic existence is innate ignorance. So the acquired ignorance isn't, you know, it's not. Okay, then we're going to skip a little bit. Even though all the schools below the Svatantrika assert the validity of those phenomena, such as the aggregates and cause and effect and all these things, they are unable to establish their validity when it concerns the meaning of mere designations of this or that by name. In other words, all the lower systems, meaning non-prasangika system, okay, they assert that cause and effect and the aggregates and all these different things, you know, you and me and ice cream and all this stuff, that all of this exists, yeah, but they can't really establish the validity of these things under when it concerns the meaning of dependent designation. Okay, so they can only say these things exist if there's existence by its own side. If things were merely imputed by concept, these schools cannot say that something is established as existent. Yeah, because to them, if things exist merely by being imputed and there's nothing from the side of the object, then anything could be called anything. You can invent anything you wanted to and say it exists. That's from their viewpoint. And so that's why they can't establish conventional existence based on dependent designation. They can only establish conventional existence if they say that there is something really in the object that makes it what it is. So that you can't call anything anything. Okay. Whereas the Prasangika is the exact opposite. They say if there's something that exists from the own side, the side of the object, then you can't establish it conventionally, because something that exists from its own side without depending on designation can't exist at all. It would be totally independent of all other factors, which would mean it would be non-existent. Yeah, and the Prasangika says the only way things can exist is by dependent designation. There's no other way. Yeah. And then the Svatantrikas, they want to go half-half. You know, yeah, it has some existence from its own side, and we posit it. You know, I want the best of both worlds. But you can't have it that way, because as soon as there's some existence from its own side, there's no use for any positing. Yeah. But from their side, if there's no existence from their own side and it's mere label, then everything's chaos. Okay. So it's really quite interesting when you think about it, you know, the difference between the lower schools and the Prasangika. I mean, they look at the same thing and say totally opposite things about it, completely opposite. Yeah. Therefore, this is referring to the lower schools, they assert that if the object of a conventional imputation is found, they consider it to be validly established. In other words, if you search for something with ultimate analysis and you find it, then it's conventionally established. Okay? If it is not found, they consider it not to be validly established. So if you can't find something when you search for it, then it doesn't exist. Okay? Thus, they do not assert the validity of functional phenomena such as causation and production through mere imputation by thought. They only assert those things saying that they exist from their own side.
But then if they exist from their own side, how did they establish causation?
Well, they say that things have to exist from its own side.
Right.
Otherwise, a pea could produce a tulip. There has to be something inherent in the pea seed that makes it produce a pea.
So it almost sounds like their definition of truly existing is different than the Prasangika's definition.
Well, they're saying that there's something findable uh-huh. in the object that makes it what it is. So that's the same.
Where does that come from, that findable thing?
Well, they say that that's just the nature of the object. Yeah. Like if we look at the self, there is something that you can find that identifies who a person is that carries karma. Because if we can't identify the person that carries karma, then our karma would just, you know, go wish-wash. There would be no way to say that it went from one life to the next. Okay? So they say everything works because there's existence from its own side. The Prasangika say, but it can't work if there's existence from its own side. Okay? Chandrakirti's explanation of the thought of the exalted father, Nagarjuna, okay, and his son, Aryadeva. Whenever you hear father and son like this, it usually means Nagarjuna and Aryadeva. Sometimes you hear it in other contexts, and it means Jay Rinpoche and then Gelsa Jay and Kedrup Jay. Okay. Chandrakirti's explanation of the thought of Nagarjuna and Aryadeva describes it as the most amazing exposition of the undistorted essence of the teaching of the Buddha, the transcendent subduer. It is able validly to establish causality and production, the perceived and the perceiver, the attainment and what must give rise to the attainment through imputation by thought. Okay? You might remember when Guy was here and he was he was talking about this because there's a verse in the Karikas, Nagarjuna's treatise on the middle of the way, saying, you know, how astounding it is, how it's wonderful. You know, I think that verse is anyway from Treatise on the Middle Way, one of the scriptures, and saying, you know, it's a wonderful, most amazing of the amazing thing that you can negate inherent existence and validly establish cause and effect. Yeah. because it's such a delicate fine line to do this without going into absolutism and without going into nihilism, but just walking that very fine line. Okay? But so, and you know, in one way they say it's just this very fine line, like, you know, it's so amazing that you can negate true existence and still establish conventional things. Yeah? And it's, you know, because sometimes when you think about it, it's like, well, if you negate true existence, then how are you going to establish anything? Yeah? If something doesn't have some existence from its own side, how am I going to say it's there? Yeah? So when you look at it that way, then it does seem very difficult to establish causation and conventional existence. But then when you're able to do that, then you can really see how they say it's, you know, so amazing and so wonderful that you can do that without flipping to either of the two extremes. Yeah. And either saying, well, nothing exists at all, or there is existence by its own side. Okay, so just as Nagarjuna has said, knowing that all phenomena are empty like this, and relying on actions and their results is a miracle amongst miracles, is magnificent amidst magnificence. So it is Nagarjuna who said that. Okay? So knowing the phenomena are empty and they also function, you know, actions and results also function, it's a miracle amongst miracles, magnificent among magnificence. So having that understanding is, that's what we want to get to. The meaning of existence of its own accord, okay, so existence of its own accord from its own side, by its own power, by its own characteristics, all these things mean the same thing, without being merely designated by the force of thought to persons or on persons, aggregates, and so forth, lies in all the objects' marks of true existence, which are exaggerated by innate ignorance. Okay? So things seem to have existence from its own side, from its own accord, you know, and this is what it truly is, and this is totally an exaggeration by ignorance. When the basis for the designation of this is the person, it becomes the selflessness of persons. Okay, we went through this before. When the basis for the designation of this is the aggregates and so forth, it becomes the selflessness of phenomena. Okay, Chandrakirti's commentary to Aryadeva's 400 verses says, self here is that inherent existence of a phenomena that is not dependent on others. Okay? Here, this is the definition of the object of negation for the prasangikas. Okay? Self here is that inherent existence of a phenomena that is not dependent on others. So an inherently existent phenomena is not dependent on anything else. It has its own inherent essence, independent of causes and conditions, independent of parts, independent of being labeled in relationship to something, independent of being labeled by depending on a base, independent of absolutely everything, this thing has its own mode of existence.
So is that only a prasangika definition, or
yeah,
the lower school?
No, that's only a prasangika definition. Oh. Yeah, because the lower schools say, you know, that there is something there.
Right.
Okay. So self here is that inherent existence of a phenomena that is not dependent on others. The lack of this is selflessness. This should be understood according to the two categories, persons and phenomena, as the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena. So that's a very clear quote there. Okay. Then, how do things exist? They exist by dependent designation. Okay? So the way phenomena are designated by thought is stated in the questions of Upali Sutra. And there's just one verse here, but there's actually quite a long quotation, I don't have it with, from this sutra that's really very beautiful. The variety of blooming flowers and the magnificent radiant golden castles are not created by anyone. They are designated by thought. For the world is posited by the force of thought, by the force of labeling. Yeah. The variety of blooming flowers. Did you notice the daffodils came out today? First day. And the magnificent, radiant, golden castles, like Gotami House, are not created by anyone. Okay? So they're not created by any, you know, creator, absolute creator, who makes things come into existence, or any primal substance or anything like that. They are designated by thought, for the world is posited by the force of thought. So that's pretty amazing when you think everything that you look and see around you exists by being posited by thought, and that's the only way it exists, is by being posited by thought, that there's nothing there in it that makes it it. That all these things exist only on the level of appearance. Yeah, they only exist as appearances. It's very interesting sometimes to just sit there and to say, you know, this is an appearance to my mind. That's all it is an appearance to my mind. There's nothing out there inherent making it what it is. Yeah, it's an appearance to my mind existing by dependent designation. Really kind of amazing, isn't it? You know? It loosens things up, don't you think? Doesn't your mind feel a lot kind of more looser? Especially what we were just talking about, how, you know, we get so upset with other people, they're judgmental of them. And if we just think this is just an appearance to my mind, yeah, these things exist just by being designated. They don't have an inherent nature of being bad, of being stupid, of being, you know, wanting to get me or any of that stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The example makes it easier to see, but I have a kind of hard time figuring out how the other kinds of dependency relate to the third one, especially when I think of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little harder. Like, I just don't get how things being designated conceptually relates to the kind of cause and effect.
Okay. So how,
or even on the basis of having parts.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't see how they're related. It makes it sound like the last one is all inclusive.
Okay.
Which I think is the case, but I don't.
Yeah. Okay. So the relationship between dependence on causes and conditions. Yeah, and then dependence on parts and dependence on mere designation. Because it makes it sound like dependence on mere designation is kind of very inclusive of all the others. And it is, because dependence on causes and conditions is only a permanent thing. Okay? Whereas permanent things are dependent on parts and dependent on designation. Yeah, so it's different ways of looking at the dependence, the dependent nature. But even if we think about causality, if you sit there and, you know, really think about something, you know, here's this cup, and how did it come into existence? Yeah, because, you know, this cup hasn't always been here. And so there were people, and there was porcelain, and there was paint, and there was an oven, and there were like all these different things. When we were at the causal stage of this cup, before this cup arose, when there were just all the different causes and conditions there, was there a cup there? Could you identify a cup? There's no cup. In any of the causes, is there a cup in any of the causes? When you had the porcelain sitting there, was there a cup hidden inside the porcelain ready to come out? Was there a cup anywhere? Was it in the wheel, in the oven, in the truck that brought it here, in the person who made it, in the paint? Was there any cup anywhere in any of the causes? No, nothing, zip. When you think of that, then isn't it kind of magic that there's a cup here? Mm-hmm. It's like this cup came out of nothing. Yeah? This cup came out of things that are not cups. Its very nature is uncupness or non-cupness. It's like it appeared by magic from all these things that are not a cup. Isn't that amazing? That you take many things that are not cups and they interact and they make a cup. Where in the world did that cup come from?
So that's how the designation goes to the cause and effect.
Well, it helps you connect. It helps you connect them, and it also helps you see that if things are produced by causes and conditions, then you really need the designation for this thing to come into existence too.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just part of the process. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because when you research into the causes and conditions, there's no cup anywhere. Then you can really see the cup has to be designated if it's produced by causes. Yeah? Okay. Thus it explains that all phenomena are designated by the power of thought. Okay? The 60 stanzas of reasoning also says, who wrote 60 stanzas? Nagarjuna. Okay? If the Buddha rationally taught that the world is conditioned by ignorance, why is it not appropriate to view the world as a misconception? Okay. If the Buddha rationally taught, in other words, with reason taught, that the world is conditioned by ignorance, so this world is conditioned by ignorance, it evolved due to ignorance. In that case, why is it not appropriate to view the world as a misconception? Yeah? So if this world came into existence under the influence of ignorance and is conditioned by ignorance, why should we think this world is true? Doesn't make much sense, does it? What this means is that worlds do not exist by their own nature, but by mere designation. Okay? So anything we look at, the whole universe exists by mere designation. 400 stanzas also says, who wrote 400 stanzas?
Aryadeva.
Okay. If there is no imputation by thought, even desire and so forth have no existence, then who with intelligence could maintain that a real object is produced dependent on thought? Okay. So if there's no imputation by thought, nothing were imputed, then even desire, anger, resentment, hurt feelings, belligerence, all those things could not exist. So all of those emotions that we're so tangled up with, if they weren't imputed by thought, they couldn't exist.
Wouldn't the basis of designation still be that, for these things?
But the basis of designation is not the object designated. Yeah? See, that's our trouble. That's one of the misconceptions of ignorance, is that we confuse the object designated with the basis of designation and think that they're together. Mm-hmm. But that's the whole thing, that when we analyze, we're looking for the designated object in the basis of designation, and we're not finding it in the basis of designation or separate from the basis of designation. But this is one of the things that just in our daily life, you know, I look over there and, you know, there's the kitty. Yeah, there's the kitty. I don't think there's the basis of designation of the kitty. I think there's the kitty. Right, Ach? Yeah? And yet, you know, my mind's confusing the basis of designation, the aggregates there, with the cat. Okay? Speaking on a conventional term, a conventional way, that's fine. If you say, where's the cat? You know, conventional analysis says cat's right over there. Okay? So that's not what we're doing. We're not saying, where's the cat? On a conventional level. Okay? You know, because that's conventional analysis. Where's the cat? Well, let's see. He likes to sleep here. He likes to sleep there. But he's not he's in one of those places. Okay, so that's conventional analysis. But ultimate analysis is when we look on the basis of designation. Yeah, that body and, you know, feelings and discriminations and conditioning factors and consciousness. And we say, where's the cat? Yeah. It still looks like there's a cat there, doesn't it? But remember the example we're coming up with on that, with the rope and the snake, that there's absolutely no snake on the rope, and in the same way there's no snake on the body of the snake. So there's no cat there where we see a cat.
But I think that's fine about us, but not about myself.
Oh. that's okay not to find the cat, but me, it's not okay not to find.
I'm
merely designated. Yeah. It's very unnerving, isn't it? I'm merely designated. No, everybody else is merely designated, but I am real. I am real. I don't exist just by being designated. There's not just a basis of designation and a name here. There is me.
I'm the designator.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the designator. The whole world depends on me. Yeah. The independent designator. Yeah.
That's
where my mind goes. I'm designating this and I'm designating that. Yeah.
That's
kind of
okay.
Yeah.
And then when I go, I exist by being merely designated. Whoa.
No, that's not okay, is it?
No, that's so not okay.
Yeah, it's not okay for me to exist by mere designation. Because I'm real. Therefore, from the viewpoint of imputation by thought, although lacking existence by the way of their own nature, attachment and so forth are explained as being like a snake imputed to a coiled rope. So here it is. You know, our emotions, these things that we are so invested in, yeah, exist by mere imputation by thought. And I think actually this is incredibly healthy psychologically, especially when we hear people say, you know, I have repressed anger, because there's the idea in the mind that there's this anger and it's sitting there inside me all the time, repressed, ready to explode all the time, influencing me all the time. And we think like that and we get so tight. There's this inherently existent repressed anger inside me. And then, wait a minute, it's saying, sorry, you know, if there were no imputation by thought, desire and so forth, like anger, would have no existence. What are you talking about? You know, I had trauma and this is my anger and it's there and it's lurking in the shadows and controlling my mind all the time. I am it. Yeah, it is my identity. But if you look, what do we call anger? Okay. Yeah, what's the basis of designation of anger? A few different moments of mind that have some similarity in that they arise after exaggerating the defects of something and therefore wanting to push it away or destroy it. So some moments of mind that share that characteristic. But of course, you know, all those moments of mind are very, very different. Yeah? But dependent on all those different moments of mind, then we label anger, and anger comes into existence. Yeah? So it's not like there's something solid, concrete there that's anger, and then it like explodes. You know, there's just different moments of mind that have some similar, you know, attributes. And so, for convenience sake, we label them anger. Well, same way. We just label the seeds of anger to any kind of, you know, energy that connects one moment of one similar state of mind to another moment of that similar state of mind. Okay? But seeing our afflictions like this, I find it softens everything. Makes everything very soft. Instead of thinking, you know, I have this deep burning rage inside me, or, you know, I am so greedy, it's there all consuming me, it exists all the time, whether I'm awake or asleep. You know, that kind of way of looking at our afflictions actually boxes us in tremendously. Yeah. Whereas just thinking of our afflictions, you know, this is just something that exists by being labeled. Yeah? So, one moment of upset here, one moment of upset there, one moment up there, you know, these different moments of mind have different, you know, some kind of similarities. They're not exactly the same, are they? No way are they exactly the same. But they have some similarities. So, mentally, we put them in a group and we give them the name upset. That's all. Yeah? Isn't it amazing to think of your feelings like that?
It's a bit weird. It seems like, too, when you can think like that, then there's some space to put in some compassion,
to
put in some,
it's
not so seamless.
Right, yeah. So you're saying when we think like that, then there's space for compassion and everything's not so seamless. And I think what it does, I know at least for me when I think like that, that, you know, whatever this affliction is that I'm feeling, is just, you know, whatever I say, you know, I'm angry or I'm this, I'm that. It's just something that's labeled, you know, different moments of mind that have some similarity. I find that very lightening. And what it does is, you know, because psychologists talk about a refractory period, you know, when you're in the middle of the emotion and you can't hear anything else. When you're smack in the middle of the emotion, you can't hear what anybody else says. You can't hear their side of the story. You can't hear anything. And anything you hear, you throw it back to the other person. You're wrong. You're this. You're that. Because we're so stuck in the middle of our thing. But I find this way of thinking pulls me out of it and makes me more receptive to listening to what's going on with others. And so I think that's what you mean by, you know, it's not so seamless. It's not a seamless goal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it only works if you're poised for that inner calm state. Because my experience is that the labeling happens afterwards. Like, you've been in this full rush of emotion, and then you realize, oh, no, I'm really upset. So then it's too late, because it's already full blown. But if you're feeling that poised, like, calm state, then you get that.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying that if we're like really aware of what's going on in our mind, then when we're calm and something starts to arise, then we can think like this. But when we're smack in the middle, we can't even label it anger or resentment or belligerence at all. That's true. We can't, can we? You know, we can't even label it. Yeah. Because we're so stuck in our view of that's going on, that's causing me harm. Okay, so we have to stop now. So maybe something to contemplate or something to forget, depending.
Maybe both.
May the spiritual
teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhotse's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.